Hello everyone, it's Tomasz and this is another episode of the Fujilove podcast, which is brought to you by the Fujilove magazine. Today I am finally bringing you my conversation with Patrick LaRocque, official Fujifilm ex-photographer from Canada. I have admired Patrick's work for years and it was my extreme pleasure and honor to be able to finally talk to him about photography. I'm convinced you will really enjoy this conversation.
This is Fujilove, a podcast for Fujifilm X users from around the globe. Thank you for tuning in.
Hello, Patrick. Welcome to the show. It's really my big honor to have you here. I was already telling it a couple of times to you and writing you, I think, a couple of messages that... from all the photographers alive, and not only, you are actually one of the guys whose work really resonates with me on the very deepest level. So I am thrilled really to have you here and to talk to you about your work and your images, and you happen also to be a Fujifilm ex photographer, so it's even more exciting. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm good. Well, thank you for that. I'm never really sure how to react to that, but I really appreciate it. I'm super happy to be here.
Yeah, I think maybe 8 or 9 years ago. I don't know exactly when you started with your website and with your blog. And I remember this day when I discovered you following a couple of links, and you know, I ended up on your website, and it was this, you know, it was 5 seconds when I knew, okay, I'm bookmarking this thing.
Wow. So I actually did not know that you'd been there for that long.
I am cool. Old. Yeah.
It's... Yeah, we're all old. Can't escape. Yeah.
What have you been using before you switched to Fuji cameras?
I was shooting Nikons.
Nikons. And when did you switch?
I switched with the X100. So, you know, from the very beginning, almost, 6 years? Or
mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Pretty much. Originally, just as a fun second camera to carry mm-hmm. around, and well, like a lot, like you and like a lot of other photographers, it sort of took over my life, and I, mm-hmm. about a year and a half later I switched with the X-Pro1. I switched completely.
Okay, so you are, yeah. Today you are using, because you are shooting also commercial work, I know.
I do.
And
yeah.
Your personal projects, is everything you are using Fujifilm cameras?
Yeah, exclusively days. Yeah, completely. Okay. When I switched, I never looked back, which is mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. obvious to begin with, because, you know, the ecosystem was very, very bare to start with. 3 prime lenses and just a couple. But man, I mean, has it ever exploded in 5 years? Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Developed quite nicely
yeah,
to today,
very
right?
Nice. Don't regret the move at all, yeah.
Okay, great, yeah. Same here. Let's, I would like to really dig a bit deeper into, you know, your, if you allow, you know, into
sure.
your ideas and, you know, emotional kind of resources, you know, stuck behind what we are seeing on your images. I mean, it's so often when I look at your images, I'm asking actually myself what the actual subject of any particular photograph is, and it doesn't disturb me. But I very often with your images, I get this feeling that it's actually the mood of the image itself that kind of becomes this subject, you know? I don't need a clear subject in your shot. Is it something along those lines which, you know, you're trying
really
to accomplish?
Yeah, no, you're really spot on, I think. That's a really good observation. I when I pick up the camera, I'm not so much thinking about the subject itself, as in it has to be about something clear.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes, you know, sometimes there's something happening that you want to shoot and you want to express. But I just like picking up the camera and being inspired by pure visuals. It can mm-hmm. be light, it can be color, it can be... And it can be a lamp in my living room or my feet or whatever. It's really about... I guess capturing the mood is is a nice way to put it. Mm-hmm. And it happens, and I think it translates with documentary subjects as well, sorry. And with any kind of situation, I tend to apply that to any situation afterwards. So in between actual things happening, I'll be looking for abstractions or really purely visual things. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you actively, proactively looking for those abstracts, how do you say, or you are rather just reacting?
I think I'm more of a reacting. I'm more of a reactionary photographer than a deliberate photographer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I react to whatever is in front of me. And I try not to overthink things too much. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this, I think instinct is super important. And it's something you develop over time, I guess. But, and I think you develop that by, breaking the barriers and not sure I'm expressing it correctly. It's about not censoring yourself and not thinking, mm-hmm. okay, I can't take this image because it's not interesting before even taking the image. So I think a lot of it has to do with just owning whatever feeling you have when you have the camera in your hand and just going with it.
Mm-hmm. And do you find it, you know, I think we're kind of functioning exactly this way, like you're explaining, function in a similar, you know, kind of ways. But what I am then often struggling with myself, you know, when I grab the camera, go out, and let's say just on the streets, and exactly, I go out without any particular, you know, destination even. Yeah. Yeah. I just kind of, but, you know, quite often also I find myself then a little bit stuck, you know, like afraid that mm-hmm. without having this subject, without having this destination, and also it you know, often I come back home without any image I'm mm-hmm. happy with, which confirms kind of this theory. I'm kind of, sometimes I get this fear, you know, that without having this destination, I would be just basically aimlessly, right?
Yeah.
Do you struggle with such moments, or are you already on completely different level again?
No, well, I don't think it's a question. You know, I'm not over. But it's funny you mentioned that, because yesterday I went to the city and to buy a pair of boots for the trip, and I also wanted to test my new 35 f/2, and I didn't take a lot of images, but I was basically doing it without. Basically, I was walking around along the streets, and I took some pictures, and I was pretty sure I had nothing interesting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I came home, and I was actually surprised that most of them were kind of cool. And okay. So, yeah,
this is a nice surprise. Yeah,
it is. And mm-hmm. but I could have stopped. You know, the first couple of pictures, I could just have told myself, "Okay, this is not working," and I could have stopped right there. But I know that those surprises happen a lot. And so if there's anything that I've learned, is that it's important to push through those feelings and actually keep at it. You know, not to be stubborn mm-hmm. and shoot for 3 hours if you're not feeling it, but I think it's surprising how images just present themselves.
So those surprises, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, just those surprises later at home, yeah. You know, when you look at the... When you think back about those moments where you were actually pressing the shutter, did you, you know, at when you are pressing the shutter, I often get the feeling just after, you know, I press the shutter because I react to something, but actually almost immediately after the fact, I also get the feeling, oh no, this was nothing. transferring to my computer.
Yeah.
I download the pictures later, but more often than not, this initial feeling gets confirmed then later.
Is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. When I take a picture, it's because I've seen something and every time I really try to frame it and do it the best way possible, because I've seen it, and it happens very quickly usually, especially on street and in street photography. Mm-hmm. But so every time I press the shutter, I have a feeling that it's worth it in the end. But it's just, but you know, sometimes you're in a mood that, I mean, the light wasn't great yesterday. It was really overcast and not interesting. And so it was early morning and I was a little tired and got stuck in traffic. So all of that influences your mood and how you perceive what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, there's chaos is part of this as well, and randomness, and it's worth it to take a chance. I always go back to that documentary I saw a couple of years ago on Henri Cartier-Bresson, which is you can find on YouTube, and there's this very important moment. It was filmed before he passed away, so it's interviews with him, and he was asked about the whole decisive moment thing, and when he was asked about that, he basically shrugged and said, "Well, yeah, okay, it's really a lot of luck," which goes counter to everything we know about we tend to think about the decisive moment as something, it's a decision, so it has to be, you know, thought of and rational and whatever. And so he said it was basically luck, but he also said that it you needed to be ready to make use of that luck, to be in the right state of mind to actually use that. And I've always remembered that. And because it's something that I think is very, very important to, and goes back to not censoring yourself and just going with the flow and be ready for the images to come. And they usually do, I find.
Yeah, there's many, many discussions about Cartier-Bresson also going on. And I think he even in one of the interviews confirmed actually himself that, you know, this decisive moment was a decisive moment when yeah, the right moment to press the shutter, right? To get this and not any other kind of, you know, juxtaposition of elements in the frame and so on. But actually, I think he even confirmed himself that more often than not, he was, pre-visualizing the scene. So he was actually framing the shot and then waiting for the subjects to, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly, you said you rather don't pre-visualize, but like when on the streets, does it happen to you a lot that you actually are waiting to things to be in this and not the other order in the frame?
Not often. I tend to be more of a, like I said, I react to things. But the thing about pre-visualizing, I don't think of pre-visualizing as, standing on a corner and waiting for something to happen. I think of it as an ongoing process. I'm always pre-visualizing everything. When I'm driving, I see images and I frame them, right? Even when I don't have a camera, I'm constantly taking pictures in my brain.
When you say you see images and you frame them in your mind,
yeah,
do you then, you know,
I press the shutter, that I've got this bionic thing that I'm kidding. I'm waiting for this to happen eventually. But yeah.
Okay, you have the images in your, you know, you imagine those, the photographs, like I would say. But are you actually trying to get to those places later and really get the images, you know, you saw in your mind?
Yeah, no, never actually. Because it's usually something that's fleeting. It's usually something that's based on the light in that moment, or what it's, or someone walking by in that moment, or cars arranged in a specific way in that moment. Mm-hmm. So, no.
Yeah. So when you're shooting on the streets, there's so much happening, right? The people are moving, everything is moving, cars are moving. So it means this is often, you know, a split of a second of time, which you have actually for, let's say, framing it.
Yeah.
So it's really, is it a completely intuitive reaction? You have to react within, you know, half a second or shorter.
Yeah. And that's why it's important to train yourself and pre-visualize all the time, because that's how
in my opinion, at least, that's how you get to that point where you can react really, really quickly. And same thing, we're talking about the street, but same thing happens when I shoot with my kids or when I'm shooting for a client. It's about organizing a scene and depending on the project. But anytime there's this documentary aspect to a project, and anytime there's, it becomes about a split second. Because that's where, that's when things get interesting, I find. When you start being able to react quickly, you get sort of in between moments and inside things that happen very, very quickly as well. Not sure.
No, if absolutely. I love it. I love it. I mean, I was on the street today, just okay. two hours before.
Yeah, what time is it for you? It's the afternoon.
It's now, it's the afternoon, so it was like 1 p.m. The light was also nothing special. Even though, recently I'm also myself into a relatively new idea to me, and the idea is there is no bad light.
Yeah.
I'm also trying to play with this one because I have seen enough, great images, also from you, taken at all possible light situations.
Yeah.
It can be completely sunny. It can be pitch dark.
And it's a great challenge. People say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. It's a great challenge. And sometimes it's just a question of, I think I wrote about this. I did write about this a couple of months ago. I was shooting in Toronto for a client, and I had some time to myself when I first got there on the first afternoon. And it was like the worst possible weather. It's just like drizzle, gray, just awful, awful light. Mm. And just everything was... And this was, I think, March. So March is terrible in Montreal and Toronto anyways, because everything's dirty. The snow is melted and it's just crap. But, and I was walking down the street, I think Queen, whatever, and nothing. I was just not inspired at all. But then I switched the camera. I had the X-Pro 2, and I switched to black and white. And I switched to my contrasty preset I've created in the X-Pro 2 in black and white and acro simulation. And just seeing in black and white through the EVF, and all of a sudden everything changed. And I was suddenly seeing images that I was not seeing before. So I think there are certain things we can do to sort of trigger creativity and trigger inspiration.
Yeah. You kind of touched on the next question I was about to ask you, actually, about, I mean, you present black and white images as well as color images, right? And do you have a preference, or is it exactly like you said now? Is it a decision or your mood, it happens there on the spot, or like...
Well, I'll usually shoot in color. Okay, it's very rare that I make that decision, which is very important, to discard color and go with black and white only. Even though I love acros, I think it's freaking amazing. But it's just that it closes down some options, right? I mean, that's what you have. So it's an important decision. So I never do that. For instance, when I'm traveling. Because I want to be able to do whatever I want with the images afterwards.
Do you shoot RAW then?
I do not.
Not shoot RAW?
I usually shoot JPEG.
Yeah. Okay.
I shoot RAW for work. I shoot... Mm-hmm. And even there, sometimes I'll shoot RAW plus JPEG and end up using the JPEGs. I think they're just phenomenal.
When looking at your images, I can see many of them are... These are not the... Or let's say, at least these are not the original.
No, they're processed.
They're processed, right? Well, so you...
I do process JPEG files. But it's usually... I've started... It's funny, we're talking about the process. I just yesterday started a series on my blog called The Process where I'm going to start addressing...
I read it already. It's great, yeah.
but it's not just about processing. That's a whole idea, but I will touch on that. JPEG files today, I don't know about the other camera brands. I have no idea. I haven't shot anything else for years. So maybe the JPEGs are still as crappy as they used to be. But with the Fuji, at least, I've shot things in JPEG at ISO 4000, and I look at the files, I'm like, well, I don't need anything else.
Yeah, they're amazing from Fuji, yeah. Yeah, right.
And the important thing with JPEG files is to be aware of the limitations. So you're not going to recover two stops of highlights or shadows, mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. You've got to work within the constraints, which means you need to expose properly to begin with. So it does add a level of certain limits to how you work. But I just love the results, basically. And I think it's a great starting point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like I'm shooting JPEGs, as I would say, 90% of the time. It was just two days ago. I was shooting the evening, mm-hmm. Here at home, just, you know, and it was getting pretty dark. So, but I also like the kind of, you know, moody dark shots, yeah. very often. Yeah. And then actually I had the camera set to RAW plus JPEG, and I, after downloading them,
you compare
to Lightroom. Yeah, I kind of. I'm thinking also about writing a piece on this, or my take on this, because it's this ongoing discussion. I think we have already had enough articles on this, yeah. but still, one
but
or
it's
two more.
Yeah. yeah.
No, but you know, and then, yeah, okay, to be honest, actually, I was photographing my daughter, and uh-huh. she has very dark hair, and it was already kind of getting dark anyway. There is more detail. There was more detail in the hair, in this dark hair.
In the
RAW file, there was, you know. I mean, this is not huge when you look at the, of course, I'm not a pixel people by any means. It just happened this time that I was kind of interested because I was following a discussion online or something. So I did this test for myself. And when you really pixel peep and look at the hair, you know, on somebody's head, in the, you know, dark hair, there is more detail in the RAW.
Yeah.
So,
but it really does. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, the amount of control you get afterwards can be important depending on what it is you're shooting. Some would argue that it's always important. I don't. I don't think it's always that important. And sometimes, you know, the camera being faster, the processing afterwards being faster is more important to me. But more than that, it's I've done that exercise as well. As I said, I've shot images for clients. This summer, I shot something for Lexus. Okay, big mm-hmm. big project, mm-hmm. and most of the images I used were the RAW files. Actually, 98% of them. Okay, mm-hmm. I did for one of them. I was shooting both, and I looked. There was something about the RAW file that it was, you know, the shot was okay, but I don't know. I wasn't crazy about where I was going with it. I looked at the JPEG, and boom, that was it. Minimal processing, and I was there right away.
Yeah, sure. When you're already in the first place, you're already applying exactly one of the simulations you like.
Yeah.
So you have it just there in front of you when you open it up.
Yeah,
right?
And the detail was still there. The detail was there because it was a lit shot. I mean, it was not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that does play into it. But it's about the way it's the built-in curve of the simulation. I was shooting classic Chrome. It was just exactly what I needed. That's the file I delivered. And the RAW file would have been okay, but not as good in that case, which is surprising. Mm-hmm. I could not get there. Even looking at the other one side by side and trying to emulate it, I could not get there to the same exact spot with the RAW file that I did with the JPEG.
Oh, it would take maybe weeks, yeah, right?
Yeah,
to nail the same look.
Yeah, it's just the way the skin was rendering, mm-hmm. it's just completely different. So
apart from the, you know, image character, film simulations, and what is it about the Fuji Film X system, you know, about the cameras themselves? And let's talk now, okay, let's not talk about commercial work, something else maybe, depending on the setup. But, you know, on the streets, what is it or what was it that convinced you or, you know, pulled you in?
The handling. I mean, the just it sounds restrictive to just say the handling. I mean, obviously, it's the fact that it's the aperture ring and just getting those controls back, actual controls, right? Dials and knobs. But, you know, we're going back to the X100. It was the entire spirit of that camera. So it was the handling, but it was also how... Anytime I looked at it on the table, I just wanted to pick the thing up and shoot. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to describe and it's hard to explain to people who don't get it. And there's, you know, I even now I still read articles that say, oh, you know, yeah, whatever, mm-hmm. vintage throwback and who cares. And it's regressive to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, it's how a camera makes you feel. Whatever the camera you choose to work with, it needs to inspire you. And these inspire me still to this day. And that's it, really.
Yeah. So. This is interesting. I know the... needless to say, I'm a big Fujifilm advocate.
Well, are you? I'm surprised to hear that.
But, you know, it happens relatively often. We have guests over or whatever, and people having their cameras of different brands. Mm-hmm. And... or, you know, even my wife asks me sometimes, because someone asked her the question, is thinking about a new camera. And she asks me, okay, what should I tell this person? Yeah. I mean, like, if you would have to recommend this whole Fuji story here, what is it? Why? And, you know, to be honest, with all this, you know, Fuji love and everything, it's so hard.
It is.
To give this recommendation because, okay, looking at the settings and the specs, this is everything absolutely comparable, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you take the Sony system or whatever, Olympus, it's all good, actually, right?
Everything's good.
But this is exactly this intuitive, emotional kind of reaction to the whole thing, which maybe this person will not have at all.
Absolutely. And it's funny because I've been in the same situation where people have said, okay, what camera should I buy? And normally you would think I'd say, well, go with a Fuji, obviously. Sometimes I'll mention it, but I'm hard pressed to, because you have to put yourself in someone's shoes. And sometimes these people are, you know, they're not professional photographers. They're not going to react the same way we do. They don't have the same level of involvement with the craft itself. So you have to think about that. It's not an obvious thing to describe and explain. But to be honest,
actually, there is this one moment which helps a lot, and it's actually an important factor. It's the moment when I actually show the images on the back of the camera.
And it helps.
So there is. It's a good thing there is something about the look after all.
Yeah.
Which should count the most, right? After all, and they're amazed. I mean, most of the times. They're amazed, and especially when you start showing them, you know, images from lenses with 1.4 or whatever apertures, they're like, wow. There is something about it.
Yeah, no fake bokeh there.
No fake bokeh. Yeah, now we have it with the iPhone
7. No, that's what I was
thinking. Yeah, but, and two lenses in one. Yeah,
it's actually interesting. It's very, very interesting, actually, what's going on in photography in general and in that space. I think what they're doing for the general public is insane. I think it's and we've been seeing this for the past couple of years, and it's making life hard for camera makers. Definitely, there's this.
I really wonder how it will influence, you know, like the whole market and, you know, the sales and.
It has already taken its toll quite a bit. I was seeing graphs after the iPhone 7 about recent years and the dip, the crazy dip in consumer cameras. You know, people use their phones basically. Mm-hmm. So it is.
I guess we are in this group of a very, very actually. I didn't look recently at the statistics and so on, but most probably I could imagine we are in this actually very small group of you know, camera users. Actually, I mean, today with all the iPhones and other great phones around,
we just exploit something else. It's a different way of approaching it.
So you are a pretty busy guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, traveling, conferences, speaking engagements, and so on. We will meet in 4 days. In Fotokina in Cologne, and so on. So, because I am, you know, with the Fuji love, with everything going around, I am struggling with this myself. I can imagine with you being so busy, you have to have some kind of, you know, tricks up your sleeve when it comes to making time for your photography. Do you have enough time, or you don't need much time?
You know,
that's why you shoot so much at home.
Exactly. That's why I shoot so much at home. Photography. It's completely integrated in my life.
Completely, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, So I never. There's no, and it's actually a double-edged sword because there's like no difference between my work, and my life, which can be a bit of a. You know, psychologically, it could be a bit of a problem because you never actually disconnect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So whether I'm shooting for a client or shooting for myself or going on the street or shooting the kids, it's all like one big project, right? It's mm-hmm. all like the same. Yeah. And I'm still, knock on wood, I'm still as passionate about any of it, which is, I guess... Good.
Yeah, I love it because you are talking about things absolutely. I mean, this is just amazing. I mean, I never talked to a guy like this. I tell you honestly, because when people ask me, like, I also have a problem with this. People ask me, so what are you doing as a photographer? And I tell them, like, I shoot life.
Yeah, that's it.
But you know,
bingo.
But it doesn't make things easier. Mm. I think in terms of, like, you know, presenting yourself or.
Yeah, you're right.
Finding, you know, to the...
You're right. But who cares?
But I can't... Yeah, who cares, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard sometimes to... But you don't... I don't think we need to define ourselves, all that. You're a photographer and you're a photographer. And what people usually... I mean, the first question people... Or the first reaction when I meet someone and they ask someone new and they say, okay, oh, you're a photographer, so you shoot weddings. I don't. And from that point on, they go, well, then what do you do? Because for most people, that's what it is. And you try... And then you try to explain, and there's so many aspects to it that it becomes this big jumbled mess of, okay... And they just look puzzled and go, okay, well, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. It's and today photography is so large a space. Mm-hmm. I think we live in an amazing time for. It's funny because there's this idea that it's very hard to be a photographer. Today, because there's so many people taking pictures, and there's so many, there's so much competition. So, but at the same time, man, I mean, we can have complete control over our destinies. Basically, we can publish ourselves. I mean, look what you've done with Fujilove.
No, yeah, I was about to say it. So the whole internet, of course, story.
Exactly.
This is we are blessed. I mean, in this regard, totally. Not in every regard, but
yeah.
I mean, imagine like this 20 years ago, whatever, yeah. How many freaks or weirdos like we are with our images would you find in your own town?
Exactly. You'd be stuck in your living room developing your own stuff and nobody would ever see it. And you'd still do it probably because you were crazy, but it would never lead to anything. Today, you can, you know, we're talking right now. Just this fact that we know each other. And, you know, we met quickly in Tokyo, but otherwise at Photokina next week. Okay.
No,
I've got this project, you know, about, which is the Kage Collective.
Yeah.
So it's a photography collective, 8 photographers. And so far there's 8 of us. So far I've met Bert and I've met Kevin Mullins, Bert Stefani and Kevin Mullins.
Mm-hmm.
The other, it's going to be 5 years next year. So it's 4 years. And we've never actually met. But I know these people. Just, they're friends just as much. Because we're constantly talking. We're always in contact with each other. We work together on this common project. And next week is going to be the first time. Sorry. There's going to be at least 5 of us in the same room. In the same country.
Well, nice.
So
you are meeting
at the same time.
Yeah. For the first time.
For the first time.
Yeah. But the nice thing is, of course, you know them also through their photography.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is the initial.
Patrick,
slowly but surely, we are aiming for half an hour. I will have to be wrapping up. One last question. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's the easiest one. So, when you look at your photography, at what you are doing, at you know who you are as a photographer, do you have a? Because we have an audience, yeah, we have the viewers. Mm-hmm. You are at this side, and then it's the viewer on the other side of your photograph. Do you have a general big idea of what you are actually trying to say with your photography?
Wow, that's a big question for our last question.
We can cut it here.
No, that's all right.
I'm asking this question myself.
No, it's a great question. It's a great question. But, well, first of all, I'd say I'm never really happy. I think I'm constantly questioning and constantly afraid of repeating myself. That's my biggest. And I have this fear of doing the same thing over and over again. And I think at some point you start doing that because some things become instinctive and some things become part of you. I guess my only fallback is the fact that everything I'm shooting will not be there tomorrow. And that's my sort of consolation when I'm feeling like I'm doing the same thing over and over again, is the fact that what I'm capturing will not be there tomorrow. You know, whatever it is, the mm-hmm. street will not look the same. My kids will not be the same. Mm. My God, they changed. And you know how that is. I mean, it's just quick, insane. Right? Yeah. And everything is just moving so damn fast that I'm just sort of trying to get everything on file, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what it is, I'm aware that that's what I'm doing.
So you are doing it mainly for yourself?
I think we have to do it for ourselves to start mm-hmm. with. I think, and I've said this before, I think, but we should want to do this regardless of whoever's out there. You know, we should absolutely want to shoot and take those pictures regardless of whatever audience is out there. Anytime we talk about passion and we talk about, it comes back to, would I be doing the same thing if I was on my own on a desert island? And I would still be taking pictures if I was on my own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most important thing.
Patrick, see you on Monday.
Yeah, man.
In Germany.
For that cell phone.
Don't forget the cell phone. The cell phone. Take it with you. Did you pre-order the iPhone 7?
I did not. No, I'm going to stick. No. I'm going to stick with my 6 for a year, for one more year. And.
Okay. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I mean, we could go forever.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure the listeners will really enjoy this conversation. And I'm looking forward. We'll link to everything you're doing online. And not that people don't know where to find you, but still, you know, to do it the proper way. And have a great travel, you know, safe travels, and have a great night.
Thank you, man. I'll see you in a bit.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Fuji Love Podcast. Stay up to date with Fuji Love. Follow our Facebook page and join the Fuji Love Facebook Readers Group. Head over to www.fujilove.com for all the necessary information. Take good care, and we will talk to you next time.